Welcome back to the Austinpreneur Podcast, where we discuss the stories making Texas a global hub for technology, venture capital, and startups. I'm your host, Nick Spiller, Venture Principal here at Capital Factory. And today we have a very special guest in Jesse Lozano, who's the CEO of Inelectable. Jesse comes from London. He studied political science and government at the University of London, earned a law degree as well from King's College London, and he founded PyTop and was named Entrepreneur of the Year by EY in London, which I know is a very prestigious and hard to get accolade. Ended up over here in Austin at Capital Factory and recently started Inelectable, which is in our portfolio now. And he's been working on generative AI models for longer than most. And a lot, like probably one of the first people I met that was working on it significantly before the big consumer release of ChatGPT. But Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, awesome. Great to be here.
Welcome to Austinpreneur, our show about the stories that made Austin, Texas, a global hub for startups. The show is produced by Capital Factory and hosted by me, Nick Spiller. As a reminder, by joining Capital Factory, you can plug into the ecosystem where the stories on the show were set. Learn more about us at capitalfactory.com. For those who aren't familiar, tell us what you're up to at Inelectable, and then we'll dive in from there.
Yeah, at Inelectable, we automate complex knowledge work tasks, mostly in the consulting space, high-value consulting space. What our platform does is make it easy for companies to create backends, frontends, and the logic in between to automate specific high-value consultancy tasks, and increasingly other like high volume, large data set tasks.
Yeah. And so let's go back to your first company, PyTop. I believe you raised over $30 million for that one in the ed tech space. What inspired the move from ed tech to what you're doing now at Inelectable?
I started PyTop when I was 26. Previous to that, I was doing web consulting in Parliament, and I built an automation company that I sold. And then I started PyTop. And I got into PyTop because a friend of mine was building an interesting kind of thing out of the Raspberry Pi. And I was like, hey, I think you should like Kickstarter that. And he was like, all right, let's do that. So we did that, and it got wildly out of control. And that's how I ended up building an edtech company.
Yeah.
That's what happened there.
And so I was. You gotta be careful with those crowdfunding campaigns. If it goes well, you got some work to do.
Yeah. And actually, we went from like 3D printed prototype to production, sending out over 1,000 laptops in 7.5 months. All that to say, I didn't really mean to get into edtech. I just ended up getting into edtech and growing, putting computer science into developing nations around the world. And yeah, raising $30 million for that. When you have a lot of time in hardware and also dealing with governments, you're on planes a lot, and you have a lot of time to think about what you're going to do next because hardware is hard. And it's still a great company, still going and still doing awesome stuff. But I saw the rise of LLMs. I saw what was happening within the world, I guess, a little early, and I absolutely had to be a part of it. I'm 37 now. I've got another 10 to 15 sort of hardcore years in me, and I think there was like the internet in the early 2000s, and there was the App Store, and now it's AI companies, and I think that's going to it's the only thing I would want to be involved in right now, building a business.
You were building software for quite some time before the LLMs were released. When you first saw what those tools could do, what went through your mind?
Yeah, so the very first thing that came to mind was with Inelectable, we were doing RAG before it was called RAG. And I thought, wow, the original premise of the business was I do a lot of proposals in my at PyTop, we did a lot of proposals. And I thought with LLMs, we can inject information into an LLM in real time, and then we can give proposal writers perfect access to perfect information all the time everywhere. And this was pre-ChatGPT, and it solved a huge problem at the time, and it still is a problem now, like hallucinations. But at the time, it was LLMs were like an interesting chatbot, but they weren't accurate. And so that was one of the first kind of like interesting things that we did at Intellectible was developing a proprietary RAG system.
Because you had worked on a lot of proposals at PyTop.
Oh, yeah.
Correct?
Loads.
Like how many, like, how did you end up getting your customers at PyTop, and how does that tie in with the proposal piece?
Yeah, so in the beginning, we launched a crowdfunding campaign. We sold $250,000 worth of laptops doing that. And then I brought on a great sales team. We went out and interacted with education distributors and companies like Micro Center here in the U.S., wholesaling the product into those companies. For that, there's a lot of emailing back and forth. There's a lot of filling out distributor forms and negotiating, et cetera. Then once we started doing that, notoriety built up and we started getting invited to tender on large government projects. And so one of the bigger ones we did is we deployed computer science into Argentina and shipped a lot of product out there. That took us to, it was a $3.5 million deal that was expanding every year. It took us 8 to 12 weeks just to write the proposal, and that was 5 people on that pretty much full time the entire time.
How long was the proposal?
That one, I think it was like two or three hundred pages.
Yeah,
absolutely massive. Yeah, because you're doing computer science from 8 to 18 and speccing out the hardware, the software, the content, everything that you're providing into the country, matching it up to the requirements. Just to understand what you need to put into a government, there used to be weeks of learning what you've got to supply.
Right.
But with Intellectible, a lot of that hard-fought experience, we've been able to develop a platform that can automate the consumption of those types of proposals, give you exactly what you need to produce, take your company's information, apply it towards, create all the relevant sections. And yeah, we have companies now that work with a lot of consultancies in this space. They've gone from taking clients 30 days to deadline to now taking clients 7 days to deadline. So that gives you a kind of an idea of how much time is saved and how much ROI you get out of a platform like this.
So you'd spent time in the trenches of putting together these massive proposals.
And, oh, yeah.
And won some and got good at it. And then, and so I imagine when you saw what the LLMs were doing, it was a big light bulb. And man, that's a pretty valuable thing that...
Oh, yeah, 100%.
That software can do for me now.
I think that having done a big hardware company and then going down this software-only route, which I'll never say never, but I'll never do another hardware company again. The margins are so tight in hardware. And I think the easy thing in hardware is once you've developed a product, you can sell it once if you've got good salespeople. The easy thing about software is that you can get to an MVP stage pretty quickly for an idea, but then it's selling the software into, for me, a B2B environment. That's the hard part. You really have to build something that people are going to use. And I think the interesting thing about LLMs is that it opened up a new approach to software and made the kind of environment easier to go to companies and say, hey, I've got this new approach. And they're not just, oh, you're another SaaS platform. Yeah. It's, hey, look at this. And when they see it, sometimes you get audible gasps from people about it. And it's B2B software, right? And they're literally amazed by what they see. Yeah. And that it's an interesting time for people building out SaaS.
Yeah. And what has been the process at really understanding your customer at Intellectible and perhaps maybe understanding who isn't your customer as you enter this relatively crowded space of just general AI applications?
Yeah, for sure. I don't believe in boiling the ocean, and I've been building tech companies for 16 years. And I should preface this by saying I've seen every approach win, right? I used to think that there was very specific ways to win. I've seen it all now, and so this is just my approach to it. But when you're looking for me, when you're looking to grow a business, it's a stepping stone thing. You want to find a great, good quality customer that's going to help you develop your product by interacting with them heavily, and you look for a problem that's pretty big. My problem set, proposal writers take a long time to write things. It's a really difficult job, and the problem is so pronounced that people are willing to accept things that aren't super polished. And that's with Intellectible, obviously, 2.5 years ago, things were not super polished, but there was this inherent power behind the platform that was really interesting for these companies. As we've grown, you take different types of customers. We've had small startups, we've had really big companies, and we've had everything in between. And we found that for us, the kind of larger legacy consultancies, especially within the DoD and DOE, that are needing to scale without headcount, without adding headcount, and do things at volume. That's our really specific ICP that we go after. You have a compounding problem for them, which is there's a bunch of AI companies out there trying to eat their lunch, right? And these companies are legacy, but what do they have? They have experience and they have reputation and they have really high win rates. What does AI not have? AI does not have experience, reputation, or high win rates. But when you work with a large company, like one of our great customers, Inspiralia, multinational consultancy, very high win rates in the proposals that they do. And what you're doing is you're enhancing their really great proposal writers to get to the end stage as fast as possible so that they can then do the human stuff, the like strategy stuff that actually gets the proposals into the win bucket, right? And so, yeah, going after that kind of specific niche, but that is big enough to build out like a $100 million ARR business. That's how we're taking the approach. And then as we build a really good kind of foothold in that market, we'll branch out into other markets.
Right. So you got a company that has a large business, but it's under threat, and were they looking for AI? Is this something that they're like actively pursuing when you meet them, or is it more of like you got to open their eyes to what they need to do here?
I think everybody is actively pursuing AI in some way, or they're aware of AI in some way, but it's what are the actual practical applications of this? And the big difference between us and a lot of other AI companies is that we work with these large providers of kind of knowledge work, and our platform enables us to conform the automations that we do to their specific processes. It's not a bunch of 35-year-olds going to these like 20-year-old companies that really know what they're doing and saying, "Hey, trust me, I've got AI and you need to do it our way because this is how we've built the specific pathways." With our low-code, no-code, node-based interface, we're able to very quickly create super powerful automations that are like the exact digital twin of what these companies are doing. And when you do that, you're really integrating AI into their actual business process and delivering practical AI that like normal people can use. And so, yeah, they're looking for it, but also there's just a lot of stuff that just doesn't work. Yeah. And it promises a lot and kind of underdelivers. And
And I'm sure you had a pretty good your perspective on the original digital transformation of just getting these companies off of pen and paper into software in general. What lessons to take from your early years developing software into taking Ineluctable to market?
Yeah, I think for me, it's always been about like building some, it's like power over all else, right, for me. And I think if you build really great feature sets that like cannot be ignored, they might not be the prettiest looking things in the world, but they're super useful. That's what you've got to do. And when I did a law degree, I didn't want to be a lawyer. So then I started building websites for politicians in the UK. And then I realized that I could automate things that they cared about, specifically like sentiment analysis of news. Was my solution the prettiest? No, but was it the best at doing sentiment analysis for politicians in parliament? Yeah, absolutely it was. That's how you get customers that are going to keep using your platform forever. You build a powerful solution, not the prettiest. You do the pretty stuff after Series A. Yeah.
And we're here early 2025. What are you seeing as the next trend in AI?
Now everybody's talking about agents. I think that it's almost can be like a fool's gold like pathway, right? In that if you're building like static agent, there's a lot of, if you're building static agents that just do a thing and then you've got to rebuild the agent and you've got to retrain it and all this kind of stuff, that has its own problems because it's not like, you got to have a really big team. It's a really large cost footprint to do that.
The space is moving so fast. Yeah. You can't just keep updating it.
So like my viewpoint on this is that we're building a platform. We're building a framework platform that is different from other framework platforms in that we have everything pre-piped, everything. We don't use any third-party applications. We have open source foundational models that we host that are owned by us. The landscape, I think micro SaaS is dead. Basically, and they just don't realize it yet because what you can do with a low-code, no-code, node-based interface plus generative AI plus like a snappy, easy-to-put-together UX on the front end, you can basically replicate any micro SaaS. Larger companies don't have to have a large amount of like random micro SaaSes that they're buying to do specific bits and pieces that kind of work within their company. You can create these like hyper bespoke automations or just like AI native apps, right, that sit within a company's actual working process. And so, yeah, I think that there's going to be really big framework winners that basically consume most of the AI market, because why buy a bunch of different agents from a bunch of different companies when you can just create all of the agents that you need in one unified platform that's always getting investment and always getting better? That's the key. So I think if you're working on a flashy UX agent that you have to keep building yourself, inherently you're going to lose. It's like, why did Google win over Yahoo? Yahoo employed 10,000 people to like map the internet, and Google just made an algorithm. It's the same exact thing. You need to give companies and their engineers the ability to build out really interesting things so that you can take the whole market. If you're employing people to build things that you're then going to sell to these companies, and you constantly have to pay your own people to build more and more like very specific things, then you're just going to lose. So that's the trend I think is going to happen, that maybe I haven't seen it talked about a lot, but I think frameworks and how you really integrate AI into a company, but at scale and at breadth,
we have a history of talking about things that come true before everyone else is on this podcast. So this could be the next one. So you've raised some seed funding last year. Let's unpack that a little bit. What led you to get the round done?
I set the background a little bit in that I built PyTop. I raised money for that. I needed to come over to the U.S. and start a U.S. office. My investors were like, you should move to Austin, because that's where, this is like 2016, that's where everybody's moving. That's where it's going to be great. It's 4 hours to California. It's 4 hours to New York. This is back when you still had to fly to meet investors and all this kind of stuff. You should move to Austin. I was like, great, I'm down for that. So the other guy in my company that had an American passport, he came over here. I sent him over here to set everything up. And I get here, And we land in Capital Factory, because this is just the obvious place to be, or at least that's what he told me. I get here, I was like, man, this place is awesome. And I immediately thought in my head, when I make another business, I'm just going to come straight back to Capital Factory and say, hey, let me be a portco of this place, because it just was so obvious for me to be a part of it. Now, we were too late stage with PyTop to be a portco of Capital Factory. So that's how I got introed into CatFact. Yeah. And then
I remember that was right the same year I joined Capital Factory's team. And I remember I didn't know you, but I knew your company because I'd see all the PyTop boxes around It was, now we have a lot of hardware companies. I think it's a lot much more common. But back then it was very rare and interesting to have you working on that in this space.
Yeah, yeah. And it was fun being here in that period of time. But so then got into, did exactly what I thought I would do, which was start another company, came straight to you, wanted to get in.
We had lunch right on the other side of
We had lunch right over there. I took you through my vision for Intellectible, which was a bit different then than it was now, but that's what happens in startups. You find customers, you pivot to the right thing. I met my first big customer here at Capital Factory, first big Fed consultancy customer here at Capital Factory at Fed Supernova. I then met Sales Day from Techstars, got into Techstars Boulder, which was a hybrid thing. I could stay in Austin whilst participating in that. Did the Techstars demo day and then went straight to Linden and was like, hey, I'm raising money now. So Linden did the email blast out.
Investor relations associate.
Yeah. And then got introduced to Mike from Circadian Ventures and then took him through what we were building. Ended up closing a $1.5 million seed round through that intro, and then also took an investment from Anorak out in California, and they were one of the first investors in Anduril, so great investors to have on our cap table.
Yeah, one of my favorite success stories from that year and from the investor relations team. And
yeah, Linden. Mike even in his annual meeting, he even put the email up that Linden sent him saying, hey, we've got this interesting company, Intellectible. You want to talk to them? And I really like their outfit. They like second time founders, because we've made a lot of mistakes and you learn from them and try not to repeat them the second time round, or in my case, third time round. And really great team.
Yeah, I think that we met Circadian. That email was shown at their LP Summit at Venture Atlanta.
Yep.
And Allison, the CEO of Venture Atlanta, was just on the podcast.
Yeah, and I met her at the startup crawl.
Yeah, we pulled them down here, and we're building a bridge between Atlanta and Texas.
Yeah.
And Electables, right in the middle of it, is a budding success story that we're working on together.
Yeah, yeah. It's great.
All right. I'm going to hand it over to y'all for some questions in a second. Aaron has a mic that he'll pass around, or y'all can pass around, but he'll give it to you. But we've talked a lot about success and what's led you to raising rounds and having hundreds of schools use PyTop over the years. But tell us one significant challenge you've had to overcome as an entrepreneur that really strikes you as a tough battle that you've faced.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely the toughest thing was dealing with COVID. We were at that time, the whole special thing about PyTop was that it's a in-classroom solution, right? Learn by doing, tactile, hands-on, all stuff that was not good during the COVID era. And then every single school in the world shut down. So all of our customers stopped buying product, and you have to deal with the ramifications of being a nearly 150 employee company with a lot of offices that used to be mandatory, right? To start a company, you have to have offices and all that kind of stuff. And going through that was a big ego death thing that happens there, and pretty tough, but definitely made me a better person, made me a better entrepreneur. And I could talk about a few of the specific lessons out of that, but
yeah, let's talk at least one of them.
Yeah, I think for me, at least, when you're building a business, it's really easy once you understand that you just have to do what's best for the business, right? You can't let your personal emotions or the way that you feel about something affect what the real correct decision is. And it's, for me, maybe it's like a sixth sense or something now, but you just inherently know what the right thing to do is. And you should just do the thing. That means if it's letting someone go who's not performing, you should just do the thing. If you've got to really attack events in order to grow your company, you have to go all in and do the stuff. It doesn't matter what your personal situation is in terms of whether you like traveling or whether you can work 12 or 14 hour days, etc. You just have to do what's right for the business. And when you look at it through a lens of that as a CEO, I think it gets really easy to run a business, because there is a lot of the times when you're making a decision, there is only like one right thing to do.
Yeah, logically easy. It still seems just like the emotional wear and tear can break down on you, or wear on you, and you got to overcome that.
Yeah,
just, it's hard to avoid it.
Just detach yourself from all emotion, right? And then you're fine.
Yeah. I'm sure there's people that wouldn't recommend that, but I know that's...
I say it tongue in cheek, but yeah. And that's not to say that you take actions like a robot. It's more just you have to treat everybody with respect. And I'm a big believer in the golden rule, treat people as you want to be treated, but also... I expect myself to be an A-team player. I only want A-team players on my team. And you have to be respectful to the rest of your team, actually, that are A-team players, and the way that you're like behaving and the way that everybody is working, so that you keep a really strong, like positive but hardworking like work culture. But I found that a lot of the times if you really think about something and take an objective viewpoint of it, you can... You know what you should be doing. You know you shouldn't be spending that money there, or you shouldn't do this, or you should be going to this event even if you're tired, or you should be trying to email people as quickly as possible, and you should be doing these things. If you don't do those things, then somebody else will, and then you'll just lose to the people that do those things.
Yeah. Yep. I think having the A players, the talent, is one of the hardest things. And it's one thing when you get hit with a black swan event and you really need to like re-swizzle the company and do some things, but making sure you have the best, most talented, have and retain the most talented people is paramount. And it's possible to stay alive as a company while not holding yourself to a standard of excellence. I don't think it's possible to succeed as a venture-backed company if you don't do it. And so I know one CEO I heard say is, I think this is a common thing, but it's like, you got A players, B players, and C players on your team. The A players are the ones you really need to lean into, are probably producing 80% of your outcomes.
Yeah.
The B players you can coach into an A player, the C players need to go. And like that was just in a very simple way to frame it in three different buckets and just manage from there. And I've found it to be very effective and just necessary, like in what we talk about doing. And if you're raising money to build a world-changing company.
Especially if you're going down the venture-backed route and you're not trying to create a lifestyle business, like inherently you have to go out and compete against hundreds of other companies and people that are trying to win against you.
And And it's not that the C players are doing like incredible amounts of damage, other than they're going to just scare away your A players.
Yeah, and they're going to leave.
And then the A players might actually compete with you and some other company and take all your stuff and eat your lunch.
Exactly.
So anyways.
Rule of the jungle, basically.
You got to have a good team. And so love to open it up. If any of the audience members have questions, love to hear it.
Yeah, Russell Shirey, U.S. Air Force. Thanks for the chat. We're getting very overwhelmed with a lot of the LLMs and then the agents coming out and things like that. So you're designing agents on top of the LLMs. And I guess, how do you go about choosing which LLM to use? It seems the versions just keep jumping on top of one of the other. And is that just abstracted away? And I guess, like I said, it's very overwhelming for us and how to know which ones to use.
Yeah.
Curious on your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a great question. And for us, open source foundational models, first off, we don't use OpenAI or anything that you can't run and host on your own server and completely control. The second part to that is that actually the LLM is less important, right? The important part of what Intellectable does is allow for unlimited amounts of seamless AI actions to happen with a robust runtime engine. So you can have, you're building your own personal version of O1, right? Like the reasoning models that some of these companies are coming out with. By doing that, the actual power of the foundational LLM is not that important. It's the logic sort of pathways that you push the LLM through and how, for example, extract data, apply that data to other things, combine those things that have been created into something else, and then ultimately what document or output that's creating. So for us, the models are actually just a commodity, and the ability to, for example, with Intellectable, you can put the whole US tax code in there, 100,000 pages of PDF, rag it into Intellectable, it's no problems. You won't care either, because actually the efficiency of our platform, it's very cheap to do that. You can then extract from that unlimited amount of information you've got in your library, but what do you want to extract? And this is if you're in, or actually like the Air Force Research Lab's website, right? With Intellectable, you can go to that site, you can scrape all of the news articles you've ever written, and then start extracting defense needs from those news articles, right? With the statements and the who said it, so that you can create a really great direct to phase two application. So the important part is the logic you put on the back end that you're getting the LLM to execute on. And that's that for us, that's the, So you can copy paste, insert whatever LLM you want. It's all about the logic that you as the knowledge worker are putting on the back end and then how that's chaining into to multiple things. Yeah.
Just question regarding the cost models associated with the AI agents and the LLMs. Can you share some insights on how the costing works, and because it can scale to a larger scale of cost, and how do you?
Yeah. So, costs in AI can spiral out of control like rapidly, especially if you're, and that was one of the first things with Intellectable. We were a small team, right? When we started out, me and two co-founders, the whole point, like, they always get you, right? Google's, here's $100,000 of credits, right? Just burn through it, build whatever you want, right? And then,
they don't even give you that anymore.
And then everybody builds whatever they want, and then they realize, oh my God, like, I'm going to spend like $1,000 a week on one customer, letting them run all this stuff through it, and it just doesn't make any sense at all. So from the beginning with Intellectable, that's why we don't use third-party integrations. Like, it's our own RAG, it's our own hybridized semantic search, it's our own form of database that we've built out. Everything in Intellectable is Intellectable, and because it's so tightly integrated, we're able to drastically reduce the cost, like by a factor of 100, or at some, in some instances, like with embeddings, etc., by a factor of 1,000 from what you would just get out of the box with ChatGPT or something like that. The easier it is, like from a development standpoint, to grab something and just put it into a like stack that you're building, the more you're going to pay for that thing, and then also the less good it works. Because you're using all of these random things stuck together in this kind of like Frankenstein stack that you've built out, and everything is slower, more expensive, and you have no technical moat. So everybody talks about technical moat and AI. Yeah, if you're just doing it, throwing a UX and slapping ChatGPT on the back and then saying, hey, we do like redline contracting for whatever, you have zero technical moat. Your moat is going to be, can you get customers to pay for this thing that you've built? But everybody else can build what you've just built in a weekend. Whereas, you know, when you're looking at cost and, you know, how to create a, and we're by, and how do you create an effective platform that you can sell into B2B? It's not actually about cost, it's about outcomes, but cost is like tightly integrated into outcomes. And yeah, for us, especially from the technical moat side of things, I don't think there's any other platform that would just stand up and say, hey, you can put 100,000 pages in here and not only will it work, it's not going to be cost prohibitive or anything like that. And so, yeah, a bit of a tangent on the cost thing, but costs with Intellectable in the beginning were like always paramount because we knew in order to achieve true B2B scale, you need high margins. You can't be the cheapest product out there, but you should be one of the cheapest to run products out there internally for your own team. That's how you actually achieve like a venture scalable business. Like you need to be 85, 90 points of margin. Otherwise, what are you doing?
Hey guys, fantastic talk just to listen to, exciting stuff, and best of luck on that mission. It's really cool to hear. Ian Randall, I'm CEO and co-founder of a company called Maglev Aero. We build electric propulsion, specifically highly coupled systems, both magnetically suspended rim-driven rotors and highly capable aeromechanical devices. So it's a lot of different engineering disciplines that we stitch together. It's a very coupled process. And so what you guys are talking about, these agents that are taking a fairly tedious but time-consuming process of documentation, being able to pull out insights and connect people based on relevant context, that's really exciting stuff. And that's an important part of the spend in time and resources that you apply. Is there anything that you're seeing on the AI agents for the actual engineering as well, where there's a lot of tedium involved in creating simulation models, coupling various environments where it requires a lot of handwork, where the environments that we use intrinsically use proprietary formats for how information is stored, how models are created. So it's not human readable files. And then the interfaces are graphical user interfaces, or they're way back and they still use, you know, Nastran or, you know.
That's a great question. Let me preface this by saying, so we really care about basically knowledge work automation. I think a lot about the end document that someone has to create. And then it's about automating every piece of that process. And so for us, it's not just consuming all the source material, understanding the source material, and then pushing that through a document. It's also creating agents that go and talk to clients on your behalf, gather information for you, understand if that information is enough, then ask follow-on questions to gather more information so that you spend less time on your humans talking to other humans, therefore you get higher ROI. On that side of the table, I've been involved in building out CADs and molds and creating PCBs and doing all, and then I think that there's interesting applications for what we do in some of those things, like building out your bill of materials and trying to research and find out like what would be the best options and what's inherently what would work together, all of those kind of actions. But the graphical user interface and how do you automate that, I think that's a really, it's almost like full self-drive, like the problem of full self-driving. There's so many different bespoke software applications and file types that you really will need some sort of, you really will need some sort of like artificial general intelligence that is just sat there on your computer looking at your screen that knows how to use all these things that you're using. I think we're further away from that than people maybe realize. But the good news is like your job's pretty safe for a while.
Great presentation. It's pretty awesome. I wanted to get your thoughts on, so we do portable energy storage systems and we started off B2C. And now we've cut our teeth and realized that it's really hard to do B2C. So we're not going B2B. And to get our B2B going, we don't want to build a direct sales team and hire 100 salespeople, right? We want to use AI agents to help us automate a lot of that, from marketing to sales, outbound, and so forth. My question to you is, for a small company, we typically use like smaller ERPs, like for example, Zoho or HubSpot. These platforms are offering workflow design with built-in AI to help you, agents and so forth. Can you maybe provide some greater detailed insights into what Intellectable is compared to, let's say, like one of these platforms that's offering, like Apple's even doing like their Claros platform, like FileMaker, basically is you can build apps and they have an AI layer on there and so forth. I think from what I heard from you is it's about the logic that we put into and what we train the models to the agents to do. Is that kind of, does the company retain that, or does Intellectable also get to learn from that as well? Is that kind of the symbiotic, really?
There's a lot of difference, but I'll start by saying one. So Intellectable does not learn from your source material or anything that you put onto the platform. That's like a key thing, especially within high value consulting, right? These companies have their own special sauce of how they do things. And it's like when you build some extension for Salesforce, right? It's not like Salesforce suddenly owns that. It's your IP, and that's like an important thing, I think, within this market. You can replicate like learning, because we do things in real time very efficiently. So you can replicate learning with RAG on the platform and the way that you can build out the back end to your automations. The key to Intellectable is that it is like an omni piece of software that you can build any automation on. And so it's not about, okay, I've got a large customer list and I'm specifically doing CRM stuff and I have to do it on the HubSpot platform. It's about easily being able to create a back end with unlimited amounts of AI actions that aren't going to cost you a lot of money to run. It's then creating a nice, snappy front end, like a Wix website builder that has text boxes or buttons or file upload options or any variety of styling or insert video here, do this there, that enables you to then create like a perfect for that specific task automation. And then have the connections to other things like HubSpot. And we just rolled out a SharePoint connection where you can bring things in from SharePoint, push things that you've generated back up to SharePoint. And we'll be pushing out a lot more connection-based things with the automations that you can do. That'll mean you can suck things in from HubSpot or other API-enabled pieces of software. So yeah, and specifically for things like HubSpot, like I said previously, there's just no chance that you can't just rag like even 10,000 pages of something in there. And in the high value kind of consulting world, there'll be a government report that comes out and it's 400 pages long, or there's a proposal that has 28 references in it. And each one of those references is a academic article that's 50 or 60 pages long. And now you've got to read and understand and apply the stuff that's in there to the type of report or thing that you're doing, or looking out further into the future. Okay, you're doing like your annual report for your company and you're a listed business. You're literally talking about potentially millions of pages of source material. So that kind of like extreme scale is really where we're focusing in on. And you'll just never get that out of a platform like HubSpot or even a lot of these kind of AI companies that's what happens if we like put AI on Zapier type stuff.
Last question.
All right. Bruce Boville, Cold Cycle Coffee. So I'm sold on the idea that if you build it in-house, it will probably be better and cheaper and faster and everything. But it seems like thematically the questions seem to be pointing at like, how do we assess whether a company has done that? Because I don't have the giant data that would make Intellectable useful. So how do we assess other folks? Or when you are looking at competitors, how do you assess whether they're actually going to be able to do what you're doing?
Yeah, some of the questions are easy to ask. Just ask them, what happens if I put a 400-page document into your library? Will it embed it properly? The answer to most of those questions is no. What happens if I've got an automation that has even like 100 steps, right? And sometimes you need an automation that has 100 steps. We've got automations that have 600 or 700 steps. What happens if you even zoom out on the screen and there's 600 nodes on your low-code node-based editor, right? Does it fall over? The answer a lot of the times is yes. But for us, you can go onto our site, you can look at the case studies. We work with big teams that rely on our platform to deliver revenue. It's a mission-critical thing that we do. And so when you look at the like carousel banner of the companies that we have on board, they are using Intellectable to do mission-critical proposals, research, and post-award reporting. If you get that wrong, you don't get the money. So that's one of the biggest things. And you look at our sweet spot of companies being 50 employees to 500 employees. Just signed up a 500-employee DoD company to help automate the 1,500-plus proposals they do per year. Yeah. Just ask what the platform can do, and then when they say that stuff, ask them what companies use their platform.
test the boundaries a little bit.
Yeah.
Jesse, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's great to sit here and really focus on Ineluctable and what you're up to. It's very, I realize in the middle of this, it's very common to see Jesse around Capital Factory. He's here almost more than any founder, but it's very often he's like meeting with other founders and helping them with their AI and their product. And yeah, I think very contributing community member in a lot of ways, very high contributing.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I believe in karma. So you just, you put out, you get out of the world what you put out into the world.
Great. Excellent. Join me in thanking Jesse for coming on the Austin Brewer podcast. Thanks for listening to this episode of Austinpreneur. Don't forget to check out capitalfactory.com to learn more about us and join our community. If you have thoughts about the show or ideas on how we can work together, reach out to me directly via email, nickspiller@capitalfactory.com. Shout out to the Capital Factory Dream Team for making this podcast possible, and special thanks to Aaron Handworker, who masterfully recorded and edited the show. Come back next week for a whole new episode.